Welcome to The Creative Shifts. My name is Dan Blank, founder of WeGrowMedia.com and author of the book Be the Gateway. All right, so today I'm excited to welcome back onto the podcast filmmaker Angela Tucker. We last spoke on the podcast 5 years ago, and now, in the midst of the pandemic, with theaters by and large closed, with film festivals by and large put on hold, her newest film that she was a producer on is being released, a documentary. In this conversation, we talk a lot about the creative process and what it's like in the film industry. And, you know, I primarily work with writers and artists, and I love hearing what Angela shares about the ways that film is unique in terms of how you have to deal with collaboration and with money and the timing of creative process around a documentary. But also so much of what she shares, the challenges, the joys, the purpose, resonate the same thing as it would for a musician and a writer and an illustrator and a designer. It was so great to hear her perspective on all of this and, of course, to catch up. You can find Angela at tuckergirl.com, and I will spell that T-U-C-K-E-R-G-U-R-L. And her newest film is called Belly of the Beast. All right, here is Angela Tucker. Hey, everyone, this is Dan Blank. I'm excited to be chatting again with Angela Tucker. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so this is one of those situations where the last time you were on the podcast was 5 years ago.
I know, I can't believe it. I had to go back and look. Wow.
It's one of those funny things, and I feel like this is a thing about being an adult, but especially with a career, where it both seems like yesterday, and it's also like it forces you to think about, what was I doing then? What am I doing now? And that can be a sometimes terrifying thing to think about.
Yeah.
I'm actually curious of, do you have a reaction to that about thinking about what you were doing professionally and creatively then versus where you are now?
Well, okay. So I've been in New Orleans for about 6 years. So I had sort of just moved here and was just getting my bearings together. I mean, I've worked on a lot of projects in those years, I can say. So I was not sitting around doing nothing. But you're always kind of thinking about the thing you didn't do too, where you're like, oh, there's this thing that I thought I was going to do earlier. I try not to focus on that, but you know, I have a couple of things like that I thought I would have made by now. But you know,
I just want to comment on that though, because I think that when you do things creatively and you're more on your own, you know, where you're not just showing up to a job every day and that keeps going, I feel like that's a very common thing to think about when you're running your own show or you're freelancing or, you know, when you're helping to really define your own path, is that the great thing about it is you have choice. And the negative thing about it is that you also have all these ideas of what could happen, and therefore you always have, maybe like you're saying, it moves the compass a little bit, where you're always aware of it. It's like a little bit of gravity, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had a really nice moment with a friend of mine. She had watched the film I produced, Belly of the Beast, and she was, you know, doing the thing where she was texting me with all the questions. And then she said this thing where she said, I mean, you're leaving quite a legacy for yourself. And I thought, that's so nice. And I hadn't really thought about it that way. You know, she's like one of my oldest friends. And I was like, yeah, I just am just trying to make as many things that I feel good about as possible, that, you know, can hopefully make some kind of change in this world in some way. So that was a nice grounding moment for me. And it was just nice to hear. So I'm focusing on that, which is a good thing.
That sort of feels like that's the high watermark for an artist and a creator, is that idea that your work moves people and that it lives on beyond you. And I don't mean beyond us, meaning we've passed on, but the idea that it stands on its own and it leaves that kind of mark. I feel like it's amazing that you heard that. It's amazing that you actually got that feedback, which is incredible.
Yeah, it was really nice to hear. I was like, oh, so yeah, I mean, I feel in these past few years, there've been a lot of projects.
So let's start from the present, then we can work backwards, because this is something that I was going back through our first interview, and it's working as a filmmaker seems like just a ludicrous thing for someone to do. It's like, you know, it's like I work primarily with writers and I work with, you know, artists and creators and people, businesses, and it's really hard. Like, it's really hard, all these different arts. Film in particular seems singularly nuts. For a lot of reasons that we've talked about, I think we'll cover here, some of it's the money, some of it's the collaboration, some of it's distributions, all the things. And then if you're doing documentary, and you mentioned this in our first one, it's not like you walk in with a script and you shoot it. You are sort of, and tell me, please correct me if I'm wrong, you are finding this as you are creating it in a way that doesn't offer you the kind of control that a musician or a writer has.
Yeah. Well, yes. I think if you're making a good documentary, then you're relinquishing control and you're not attached to, I feel like the story is this really specific thing. You're really giving yourself over to the story and allowing yourself to make all kinds of discoveries and allowing yourself to pivot if you thought one thing were true, but actually something else was true. So you know that you're moving in the right direction if you feel a little bit out of control. Though I would argue that that's true on a lot of fields. I think musicians, for example, I know nothing about music and have zero musical abilities. But when you watch musicians write music or just perform, they sort of get in that state that I kind of relate to a little bit of, you're just giving yourself over to this thing and you don't know what's going to come out. You don't know what's going to play. And you have to kind of get yourself in that state of giving yourself over. I think that's true for all the art. So, you know, I think that's true in documentary and, you know, in filmmaking in general. The thing that's different is there's so many other people involved in the filmmaking process. Even if you are a true, true auteur, you still need a lot of people to make this project. So I think there's the creative process and then there's just the kind of being a manager part of it too, which is actually the part that people never talk about, but is a big part of filmmaking. It's like being a manager of a lot of people.
So for the new film, for Belly of the Beast, you're the producer. And
yes, producer.
I've always understood that role to be you're in charge of making the entire thing happen. All of the organization, all getting everything together, that it's an extraordinarily powerful position, but also a very complex one, and one that, in my, again, very limited experience, you don't get the same kind of, I don't know, it's like you hear about the director of a film, but the producer, to me, yeah, it's sort of like, it's like chief of operations, they're getting it all done. What is the role? Like, what is the role for, like, for a film like Belly of the Beast? Like, what's a part of what you had to do?
Well, it's interesting because I think because I direct and produce, I'm allowed, or I'm like able to understand the different roles, and I don't expect things from producing that are things you get from directing and vice versa. So I don't come onto a project as a producer expecting to feel the things I feel as a director. It's just not the same, you know? And I love working on a lot of different creative projects, but I don't always want to be the person. It was nice to not be the director on this one. Like, it was nice to have a really wonky, difficult situation and for me to say, Erica, well, let me know what you decide on that. I'm here for you. You know, this was a really complicated movie. I, as a director, wouldn't have been able to have made it, I don't think, just for all of the obstacles that came up and sort of the place emotionally that I would have had to have been in to direct a film like this. I don't think I could have done it. I think that producing was it felt good to be a producer, and it was a hard movie to produce. Well, first I want to say there are a few producers on this movie. I think there's about one, two, Erica's one, and then there's three other people. So for me, I really am a creative producer, and what that means is I like to be really involved in the making of the film. So I'm not a line producer, which is I'm not the person who is keeping track of the money and the sort of the day-to-day. I'll help write grants, but I really, because I direct, I really want to get into the nitty-gritty of what do we need to do to tell this story. So a lot of that is going on shoots and, watching cuts, helping Erica think creatively around what extra shooting we needed to do to tell the story that we want to tell. How can we get access to the things that we need to get access to? And then, Nicole, who's also a producer on the film, she's definitely more in sort of like the line producing logistical person.
It's so funny. So if I think it figures out
what you can do, what for me, I know the kind of producer that I can be because I've done it long enough. So I wouldn't sign on to a project where I had to be a certain kind of producer that wasn't appropriate for my skill set.
Funny, if I think of this for like a writer who often it's people envision as solitary, the kind of production that you were talking about for yourself feels like, well, that would be the book coach, the person who is outside of, the main person creating it, but they're giving all kinds of resources and direction and feedback, and then maybe they hire someone who is all these different things. So it's interesting to try to translate, even just for production, the two or three or four different kinds of producers as what that would be for, again, a writer, but for another profession. And it's funny because I'm just a consumer of movies. I don't have anything to do with them. You see those credits and you see three or four producers and you see executive producers, you see the whole thing. And I always watch that, and it's a reminder of how impossible it must have been to get this thing made.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this movie for Erica was about, almost 10 years in the making. For me, it was three. I can't even believe it's been three for me. It was a very hard movie to make for a lot of reasons. I felt like I came in at a point where a lot of filming had been done, but it was still figuring out what kind of movie can this really be? Because in documentary, you can just film and film and film. And you have to sort out how can this movie end? What is a real arc for the film? What journey can we go on with the footage we have? Not just like what journey can we go on, but what can you make from what you have? That's the thing you have to keep telling yourself, I think, in film in general. Because there's no, let's just go back to the drawing board. I mean, you can say that, but that's incredibly expensive and it doesn't make any sense to do that. So my role was helping us help get it done, which I thought would happen more quickly than it did. But I do feel like it is coming out into the world at the point that it really needs to. And that's something you have to kind of be pretty zen about particularly with documentaries, is like it's going to be done when it's done.
Well, we're talking at a really interesting time for this, because it sounds like you've been on it for 3 years, and I'll talk more about that. She's been on it for 10. And, I replied to you because I got the announcement of like, hey, here's my next project's coming out. I've not even seen a trailer for it. And yeah. it's correct me if I'm wrong, it's like going into festivals, like you are starting the rollout of it. Is that right?
Yes. So, to give a little context, so I'll give the little blurb. Belly of the Beast is about is a story of their forced sterilizations that were happening in California's prisons, and we follow this woman, Kelly Dillon, who, when she was in prison in California, was sterilized at the age of 24, and without her consent, and she once this happens, and you know, she thought she was going in for, she was in pain, she thought it was cancer, they told her it was cancer, so she got major surgery, a hysterectomy, and then afterwards was kind of in a weird mental state, which of course you can imagine, and started to discover that this had happened to other women as well. And so then she works with this woman, Cynthia Chandler, who ran this organization called Justice Now, who's a lawyer, and together with a lot of other people, they work they're kind of doing effort around getting this bill passed. So that's kind of the gist of it without giving all of it away. So with Belly, we have had to keep it secret for a very long time. Erica, the longest, obviously. And so there are very few people in my life who even really knew I was like what Belly was about, that I was working on something. I'm really terrible at secrets, so it was challenging. I just like to tell people what I'm doing, you know? That's not my creative process. A lot of people have like a process where they like to keep everything quiet, and then that's like the opposite. I'm all about the focus group, because I know how to get feedback, take what I need and let it go. And I'm not afraid to tell people about things. And if they go away, they go away. I don't have like a weird thing about that. So it was hard. Obviously very close people in my life knew that I was working on it, but I couldn't really talk about all of the specifics. And, you know, a lot of that was tied to just, fear of a lot of women inside speak, and, who are currently inside. There's a lot of, you know, nurses who were sort of involved in the process, and all of them speak on camera. And we just wanted to be really mindful of any retaliation that could occur. So we had to keep it secret. And that was very challenging in terms of fundraising, in terms of, you know, this whole spreading the word about something is very hard to do when you can't talk about it. So, I mean, really the first time anyone was really seeing anything was when we started to roll out the Human Rights Watch world premiere. And so there's no trailer as of now. We're working on that now. And so it's this whole kind of COVID time and virtual premieres. We also had to kind of navigate that and decide what made sense for the film. We have a broadcast on public television, which will be in November. So that helps us like say, okay, we have the broadcast and we're just kind of working from up to the broadcast. And so that's film festivals. We're going to do a virtual theatrical. And then you'll see it on Independent Lens on PBS. So, it's quite a rollout. And we have a very involved engagement campaign that we're working on, which is, you know, like when the movie's done, in quotes, it's not done. You know, I mean, the goal is with a movie like this, you want people to be able to use it as a tool, particularly advocates for their work. So we're having a brain trust with different organizations to talk through, okay, here's the film, how can it be helpful, how can the engagement be helpful, that type of thing. So that's a whole like amount of work that no one really kind of talks about really, but it's a lot of work, and it's but it's important work because it's why we made this film.
Well, it's funny that you describe it that way, because I'm thinking of different writers I've spoken to where a lot of writers, or any creator, obviously, they want their work to have some kind of impact, some kind of positive impact, even if the impact is escapist entertainment. And what you describe is such a clear, that idea of how can this film have the impact means you've got to work with people who can use it in a certain way because they're doing work. It just reminds me of that distinction between some creators who view, let's say, the year after the release as, well, that's when I'm doing, quote unquote, the work. You know, I'm not just, I think we all, you know, we all sort of hope that what we create is like a lottery ticket and it just sort of goes out there and it spreads and people are moved by it and they take action on it without us having to do anything.
Yeah.
But that is extraordinarily rare. So it's really cool to hear how it's like part of that work for you is like the work of connection and of strategizing, you have to imagine. And that's like a whole other phase of the film.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I first started, in this business long ago, I worked with a company called Big Mouth Productions that does social issue documentaries. They made a ton of films, still making lots of movies. And I started as an intern and I started working on this film about transracial adoption. And the film was done and they just needed help getting it out there. And there was like no money. So it was perfect for me to be like intern, free labor. And I had done like a paper on transracial adoption. It was really interested in it. And so through that process of getting the film in like conferences and screenings, I mean, I had no template for how to do it. It was just kind of a lot of people who were kind of done with the film. It had been on broadcast. Everyone wanted something for it, but everyone had other things they had to do, you know, and I just was an intern and was just looking to prove myself. I was able to get a lot of screenings and get a lot of conversations happening sort of long ago. Like, I think maybe that was 2002, maybe. And so that experience, I bring it up because it was kind of my first window into this idea of a movie being done and there's still so much work left to do. And, you know, figuring out who are the right people, who really has the energy left to do the work. It isn't always the director. You know, like I think for Belly, Erica as a director will be very involved. For, you know, because a lot of the contacts are really hers and she and I will be very involved. But there'll come a point when the movie is its own thing and there'll be people who are advocates and activists and they will want to use the film without us. And that's really the goal, is to have someone use the film without you. But yeah, so I've understood kind of very early on in my career that if you want the film to be out there beyond just see it at a film festival and watch it on TV, then there's a lot of work that you have to do and you have to have real vision as to what change do you want to make with the project. And that, yeah, again, it's a lot of work.
Yeah, and that can be unclear. And I have to imagine, too, at this point, it's that really interesting place where there's all the potential, you know, it's like most of the work of the creation is done and now it's like just about to be released. So it could, you know, you're trying to figure out what can be done in a pandemic world, but right. That is sort of like, this could happen or that could happen, or we could do this, we could do that, where it's like terrifying and exciting at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really excited about it. I think I'm not terrified anymore. I think that's one thing that comes with age and having worked on enough films. I mean, listen, this is the wildest, weirdest rollout I will ever have for a film because of COVID. I mean, I couldn't have predicted that people were not watching things in movie theaters. But, you know, I really look at all the obstacles as opportunities because it's just, I really think that this film wasn't necessarily a, quote, go to a lot of fun film festivals, get drunk at parties movie, you know? It just isn't. It's like, it's a heavy movie that's looking to make some big change, and there's always been a grassroots element to it, and so the rollout of the film is part of that. And we have like the fancy, you know, fancy in quotes things. We have a broadcast. That's huge. A lot of documentaries don't have a national broadcast. So once we had that secured and in place, everything else for me is great. But, you know, I think the film is rolling out the way that it should roll out. And so the thing for me is just getting out of the way of that and not imposing the things that I think are going to benefit my career or whatever. Yeah. Instead saying, okay, what is the rollout for this film that's good, not just for us, but also the people who are featured in the film, who are very involved in our engagement campaign as well. Like, it's not like we filmed with them and we're like, good luck. You know, they're very involved.
Yeah,
they're
well,
on the calls. They're very involved and they're collaborators on this film in a different way than I've ever, maybe on my film Asexual, I would say, very different kind of film, but on Asexual, David J, who was the protagonist, and I had a very close relationship, and he was very involved in the rolling out of the film. And the reason for that, which is similar to Belly, ironically, is, you know, this understanding of this film is going to be out there forever. It's going to be about their lives. These are real people. So this desire to make everyone in the film feel good about the story that we're telling, and you know they feel good about it if they want to be involved in the engagement around it.
That's huge. I have to imagine that if you've been working on this for 3 years, that all the aspects of filmmaking are either everything's happening right now, it's important, not a panic, but it's like that crunch, or it's sit back and wait, we're waiting on something to happen.
Yeah.
Is it that kind of stop, start kind of thing?
Yes. You know, yeah, I mean, there was the Human Rights Watch world premiere, so we had to sort of come up with a way to make that feel like a big moment, not just for us, but for the people in the film. So I think we did a really good job of that, and Human Rights Watch is incredible in terms of, you know, the Q&As are just feel really substantial, and you know, we had a nice long Q&A. We did like our own little red carpet on Facebook Live with Jamila Lemieux, who's hosted it. We just decided, we did a party, a Zoom party. Like, we just were like, we're going to make this into a festive thing, right? So there's all the adrenaline getting up to that. And then now we're at the point where we are figuring out what this virtual theatrical is going to be, finalizing those partners and having this brain trust with different potential partner organizations. So that's a little more like admin-ish work in a way, you know, like it's kind of like waiting it out, having lots of Zoom conversations and figuring out, just being very intentional about the next big rollout, which I think is good. But yeah, it's there's a lot of hurry up and wait. And we keep saying we're like, after the broadcast, who knows? Like, we don't know. The broadcast is going to be a really huge visibility moment. But we're trying to just have everything bring us up to the broadcast. And so the film will get more and more and more and more visibility. So that's part of the strategy around, you know, the just waiting on the trailer, too.
Yeah, it's such a funny time too, because it's not just that you and each of you in the film are navigating the unknown of what this year is, but everyone you talk to is doing that as well.
Mm-hmm. Everybody. Yeah, everyone is. And we, you know, I can just speak about filmmakers, but, you know, there's some filmmakers who are just deciding to hold their films and they only want their films to come out in a movie theater. And if that means waiting a year, whatever, then that's what they're doing. We decided not to do that because this film has been just in the making for so long. It just needed to come. But also, this was a moment that the film really needed to be out in the world. If this were my first film that I ever worked on, let's say, and I was a director and I was like, this is my first movie ever, yeah, it would be really hard for me to know that it was never going to play in a theater. That's a big shift that I have not had to make. You know, yeah. I've had experiences where my films have shown in theaters and, you know, it's special and it's great. And so because I've had that, I don't feel like I'm going to fight for it in a situation where it doesn't really necessarily make sense. But I, you know, I understand that it's hard and not all of us can be Christopher Nolan and demand that you will see his movie in the movie theater. Tenet will be seen in the movie theater over Christopher Nolan's dead body, you know, but the rest of us have to figure out like how what makes sense for us in how people can watch our films.
I mean, is this something that I'm thinking about this in a lot of ways for even everyday businesses like restaurants, but more especially with the arts, which is everything that's happening now is sort of not exposing, but it's creating a new narrative around issues that the industry has. So with film, and again, a total outsider, is it's a weird thing where these, you know, some films get all the attention and then there's millions of others that don't. There's the money with it. There's the idea that we've had home theater and home streaming for a very long time now, of the viability of the theater system as we know it. Like, as more of an insider, or, you know, someone working in that field, how have you viewed how this is or might be changing that moving forward? How are other filmmakers adjusting?
Well, it's challenging. You know, a lot of big chains are having a hard time figuring out what they're going to do. We don't really have that much information. So it's, I mean, just when you look at what's happening across the U.S., just in terms of people opening, and some cities are in phase one and some cities are in phase two, and your phase one is different than my phase one and whatever. Movie theaters are dealing with that in their own way, where some are open, some are able to open. What is it going to be like to be in that room? What are they showing? Like, here in New Orleans, for example, a lot of the theaters that are opening are showing older films, a lot of the kind of art house films, just so you have like a, I don't know, kind of, it's how I remember art house theaters as a kid. Like, when I was a kid, art house theaters showed like classic movies. And so New Orleans, a lot of New Orleans theaters are doing that. But if you're a new filmmaker now, the system is such that film festivals are really huge for you. I mean, we've all heard all of the movie premiered at Sundance or South by Southwest or whatever, and Amazon bought it and this person's life was changed. And a lot of people want that, not just like for ego or validation, but there's just real economic realities to that. Yeah. So if a person put themselves in debt, that moment of visibility and that moment of getting your film bought is how you're going to get out of it. So I know a lot of people who were like, okay, yeah, the production still owes me like, you know, $10,000, but it's going to get sold and then I'll get it back. But that, so I say this because I think a lot of people think the visibility is like ego. And a lot of times it's just like brass tacks. Like, I need to make my investment back on this movie, and film festivals provide a moment of visibility where that can happen. So, you know, even with it, it's interesting now that virtual film festivals, people are becoming more open to doing them. But when this first started, you know, South by Southwest just had to not happen. And Tribeca had to just not happen. And those are two huge festivals that people use, that once they get into them, they're like, oh, I'm fine. Somebody will get my film.
Yeah.
So that's hard. And so that's really the moment where some people decide, I'm going to wait until I have this moment where it can be seen in the theater, or people are just riding the virtual wave. And one of the things I really do appreciate and like about this virtual premiere space is people from all over the world, not all over the world, a lot of them are geo-blocked, so all over the country, can see your film. And so in a way that they wouldn't in a film festival. Like, at a film festival, it would be whoever was in that city, and then whoever affiliated with the film happened to be at that festival. So now you do get a broader range of people seeing the film. But yeah, I mean, it's a really complicated time, and people have to ask themselves why they're making movies, I think. That's really the big question. If you're making movies to be in a room with people, to viscerally experience them experiencing your work, then this is hard, and you're not going to have that in the same way, maybe ever. I'm not sure, you know? Yeah. But if you can allow yourself to just appreciate the fact that your film is available to people in all kinds of forms, then I think you can be okay. But it's I've had to do a lot of that thinking of like, why am I making movies? I mean, I know why, and I did kind of sit down and ask myself, what does the screening in a movie theater actually get me? And it does get me a lot. I love watching people react. And that is not the same. I mean, people texting me through the movie is nice, but not quite the same, you know? But yeah, I mean, these are questions everyone's asking. Every filmmaker is asking themselves.
Well, it's funny because the financial side of filmmaking feels like it is always the elephant in the room, because if you talk about, I mean, last time we spoke, you mentioned, you know, a typical documentary is in the, you know, several hundred thousand dollar range. And of course, there's literally no limit above that. We've all heard of, you know, mm-hmm. what movies can cost, including documentaries.
Yeah.
And it's like, if you think of the small documentary, A Crew and whatever, I mean, we're now talking about the range that normal people only ever talk about in terms of a mortgage. And a mortgage is like, one, we sort of help a lot of people, we kind of drink the Kool-Aid with it. You know, it's like, well, a house costs blah, 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 thousand. And you there's the 30-year mortgage thing and all this garbage that we buy into that. But it's, then you get to live in it. The whole nesting thing happens. And it's like a home and there's value and you can justify it. But with art and with this craft, it's a whole different thing to put yourself on the line to have to, I imagine you're getting investors, you're maybe getting a second round of investors or grants, and then you're using that. Then like you're saying, the release of it is not just how does it do, does it have the impact, is it my mission, but does it get me out of this massive hole that I don't think a lot of people can really wrap their head around what that must feel like to be on the hook for that in a certain way. If you have investors, you're not, maybe the director's not on the hook for it, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, the goal is to not be on the hook directly. Maybe your first film to do that, but the goal is really to stop doing that. You don't always succeed. For me, I don't have the money. I'm not wealthy. So I am not that person who's like, let me throw another $25,000 at this problem. You know, no, for me, I'm somebody who I can through grants get money, and I have enough personal relationships that maybe a couple of, high net worth people might come in through, like, you know, tax deductible contributions, et cetera. But yeah, I mean, the thing about filmmaking is when you have an idea for something you want to make, there's a price tag that comes with that. That isn't a small price tag. That's the difference of being like a writer. You can just do sweat equity and you can do it on your own. And sure, you have to factor in, what your time is worth. And maybe you have to, you know, pay someone to help edit, let's say, or something. And that's a cost that you decide you want to spend. But it's not, when you get into a feature film, it's a lot of money. Even, you know, now documentaries have become so mainstream that you also have to make a documentary that has a certain amount of production value in order for it to be playing on a Netflix or on an Amazon, you know, like the days of, oh, I'm just going to make this crappy looking documentary, but I have access. I don't think we're in that time now. You know, there's enough films that you need to make sure, you know, it's probably 4K at this point, and making something 4K has a lot of costs to it, you know? So, now I feel like I forgot where I was going with it, but it's a real thing.
Well, it's something I think about, and it's why I love having the opportunity to do the podcast and speak with people in many fields, is because I like thinking about how it differs in each field. As a writer, self-publishing is an accepted thing you can do now, which is so different than the 1990s and before, when it would have been called vanity publishing. And
yeah,
you wouldn't have done it unless you were, you know, had a certain kind of goal. Or with artists now, where you can create and put it on Instagram and sell on Etsy or one of the many, many other places you could do it, or direct through your own website. And in those industries or those fields, of course, money is always complex, because you might be investing your own money in an editor or coach or what have you. Or if you're trying to go quote unquote traditional, then someone else is footing a whole bunch of money to publish, but you're worried about your cut or what they're taking. It's so interesting when you look at it through the lens of a filmmaker, because that industry is so brutal in terms of money, it feels like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're like, yep, I agree.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, yeah, I think it depends on the kind of movie you're making. The point you made was good in terms of there are people who I'm an independent person. I have my own production company. This movie is coming entirely out of my production company. Every like frame, shot, moment is like what I decide, and I'm raising money through either investments or through tax deductible donations and whatever. And that's kind of like one way, right? Then there's also within documentary and fiction, if you're working with like a larger entity, you know, be it like a broadcaster who gets in before you're done with the film, or a distributor who gets in before you're done with the film, and they front the money, and either they give you the money and this is just what it costs, or, you know, you're getting, I mean, usually in documentary, it'll be if somebody comes in early, they'll give you a budget, and but then you have to constantly update them as to how that money is being spent.
So that's how I view like a traditional, as I know it, Hollywood film is made, is the studio is doing it. They give you a budget, yeah, and then that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the thing. And then you're constantly kind of going, having a back and forth with the studio. And then it's a discussion of how involved is the studio creatively. So in fiction, for example, because I directed a fiction feature not that long ago, and I'm about to start another one. Fiction is very different in that you very rarely have director's cut. And this is something that, like, in movies, you hear this notion of like director's cut. And in documentary, you have it a lot more. And I think that part of that is just tied to the boulder up the hill of making a documentary. Whereas in fiction, if you're working with a studio, unless you are like very famous, you typically don't have the director's cut. So you have to make sure that you're working with a studio that you trust, so as that they're not like saying, oh, we like your cut of it. So they'll give you a period of time as a director to make your quote cut. And then they'll watch it and give you notes. And if you don't take those notes or do those notes, they can just say, oh, well, we're going to do these notes. So
that's a heavy duty point, because I think it's something a lot of other creators don't really, I mean, they experience it. You know, everyone who's been traditionally published, you know, might have had an experience where their editor, publisher really want them to change, or they give them a book cover they didn't like. Musicians, similar thing. But it's such a good point, this idea in film. It's standard, it seems like, that you don't have final cut over your work, period, unless you are one of probably, I'm just going to guess, 5 people on the planet. Like, it's that pervasive.
Like, Paul Thomas Anderson has final cut, you know, has director's cut. Martin Scorsese has director's cut, but tells all kinds of stories about all the notes he has from studios, execs, and Spike Lee tells these kind of stories as well. I mean, just so you see at the level, even people at that level still have to, you know, validate why they're doing the things that they're doing. Now, that's kind of more in the fiction world, so I want to be clear that, like, that's true in fiction. In documentary, even if you're working with a big entity, they're going to give you notes, but very rarely is it. It's not quite the same. It's kind of, you typically have something that feels a little more like the way sort of somebody who is not in the industry would think of a director's cut, which is this is a reflection of me and how I want this film to be, and everything in there is like a choice. But in both fiction and documentary, in film in general, you're going to have to make some, you're going to have to take some feedback. You're going to have to make some changes.
It's funny because even the phrase you use, notes, which I've heard in many interviews from actors, it's such a light word. And I feel like the reality of that word is kind of like if I'm getting married and like the notes, quote unquote, are, you know, is my mother saying, well, why aren't we inviting so-and-so? Like, it's not like a gentle, well, here's a note you might want to consider. It's sort of like, look, you can say no, but if you say no, you ain't going to hear the end of it. Like, this note is going to become a problem in your life. Is that like, what, can you just describe the notes process?
So the notes process is really tied to who you're working with, right? And so there's all kinds of notes. There's notes that, let's say someone on your team watches a cut and they give you notes which are like suggestions. And you can say, oh, that's kind of interesting, or that's helpful, and you can take what you want, let the rest go, whatever, right? Or if you watch it with, you know, like you'll watch your editor's cut of the film and give notes. So these are all, I think of those more as like suggestions. They're sort of like soft, right? When you're working with a broadcaster, that's when you kind of, or even like a studio, that's when you have to assess which notes are like must do notes and which are like, if you want, right? Mm-hmm. And what I try to do is when I get notes from people like that, do as many that I can, you know, as many that are like, take all of the low hanging fruit, great, cool. And then the things that feel, like that are sort of against my taste or just my general, I don't know, anything, I try to have a conversation about it to really see how passionate someone is about the note. Because sometimes some people give notes just for the sake of giving notes, but they feel no real attachment to the note. And then sometimes people are like, no, this is like the note you have to do. I don't care about the others. So, but it's complicated. I mean, throughout the filmmaking process, you're getting a lot of notes, feedback, thoughts, blah, blah.
It really sounds like a relationship, like a typical relationship.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of signals. You got to figure out which ones are the most important.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, in the fiction space, like I'm writing a script for a channel that I'll be directing it. And I hate when I have to do that like cagey thing, but I do. And the notes that I get from them, I have to take them, you know, like it's just, I can have a conversation. I can say, hey, what do you think about this note? And I do that process, like I said, where I assess, is this like a, you got to do this or not? But the notes that they have are the notes that you have to take. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's so important for people who are in kind of these, development exec positions, for those people to be good. Because if you're working with someone that isn't good, it affects the creation of the film, right? Because those notes affect the script you make, which affects the movie you make, and all the way down. So that's why I like to get on my soapbox, the lack of diversity that happens with execs in these sort of larger you know, channels and studios and et cetera, that's why it's very, very hard for people of color to make films that feel reflective of our perspective, because we're getting notes from people who don't really understand who we are just for the sake of giving notes. And then, and you have to kind of take them, and then it has a lot of repercussions. So I'm in a really unique position in that my exec is Black. I'm Black. That like never happens, you know? But I have been in situations where that hasn't been the case, and I've gotten notes that were literally like a white guy's belief system of what they think black people do, that are not, that's like not based in anything other than I heard a story. And that's when it gets kind of hard. Not kind of hard. That's when it gets hard. So I feel like that went all over the place, but
if I think about, right, I mean, it's like you clearly work on not just a lot of projects. Like if we think about like just the last 5 years, I don't know if I want to ask like how many projects, because it must be weird to count them up. It's not just number of projects that might be overlapping, but then your role is different. You might be writing something, you might be directing something, maybe producing something. You might be trying to get something rolling that might not even happen for 7 years from now. Is that kind of the life that you have?
Yes. Yeah, you might work on something. Yeah, you might work on something that doesn't happen at all. I mean, the big thing I try that I'm also a professor, so there's that too. I would say that I try really hard to not get too attached to projects, in the sense of I think a lot of people focus on just one thing and they put everything into that one thing, so that when that one thing derails, it's like they have nothing, you know? I like to work on a lot of different things so that I can sort of ride the various waves of it. And so if I have a project that's having a down moment, usually something else is having an up moment. And so that allows me to kind of keep going. I also try to have something that I'm directing that is completely independent, that's totally mine. Usually it's like a short or something, but that helps me too when I'm feeling a little bit like I'm not tangibly filmmaking enough. I'm dealing too much with like financing or notes or blah blah blah. So I try to keep one project like a year, basically, that I'm, it's like this is my thing from soup to nuts, and if it has a huge rollout, fine, and if it's just kind of like a couple of festivals and it goes online, whatever, you know. But I have to keep something that's totally mine, so that when I'm dealing with all of the other ups and downs, it's a little easier.
That feels really, really smart. And I can think of that too, where if I'm talking to a writer and they've got a book that's rolling out and it's a ton of work and very overwhelming, you know, often that advice is like, you know, work on your next book. And I feel like, one, that's a good strategic business advice, but more for the point that I think you're making is this idea of giving yourself that sense of control and a creative outlet while you're going through things that you might not be able to control with a different project.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's it. I mean, I really do love the point where you have an idea, but you don't know what it is, and you're watching the movies and you're reading the books and you're just kind of pontificating on what it is, and that's just such a fun time for me. I love that time, and no one's waiting on you to make some update on it, or you know, it's just kind of yours. And and then eventually it leaves that time and you start to involve other people, and you start to, you know, luckily if somebody gives you money for it, then they want to see, you know, then like a lot of people, and then it becomes, okay, I've got to push this boulder up the hill and make it happen and honor these deadlines, et cetera. And that's all great too, but I do really love development a lot. And I try to kind of keep that time where I'm just kind of thinking, ooh, someone should make a movie about this. Am I that person? Let me think about it, you know?
I love that. So we covered a lot. Is there anything that I haven't asked about that you think we should definitely cover as it relates to any of this or anything else?
I don't know. Well, because it's so interesting, because this is always such a, like, you have such a specific audience. Like, you know what they want to know. Yeah.
It's funny. I think so much of what this podcast is to me is, it's partly I'm aware of the audience, but it's the idea of my curiosity around the creative process and the risk taking. And it's so interesting to talk to you because, you know, filmmaking is a field I don't know anything about. And documentary especially it feels so difficult. And to sort of hear it in insider's perspective and hearing what you went through, to me, it speaks so much to the creative process that anyone in any field anywhere can be going through. And I think it helps inform it sort of frames the challenges differently, because I think every creator can have challenges and frustration. And I think it's neat when you discover, well, what is the musician's challenge and how, oh, that's hard. And like the filmmakers, I think, again, I said this before, I think it's particularly difficult a field to work in.
Well, I think that the filmmaker's challenges, though, are very tied to that person. This is something that I learn a lot as a producer. When you're a director, you're in your own kind of headspace and you have all of these things that you're managing and you're in a very different world, and no one really can feel what a director is feeling on a project because they are the person up top in terms of the creative vision is coming from them, and there's a degree of stress that they're experiencing that producers just don't experience. And I can say that as someone who produces, right? But what's interesting in being a producer is that you really, because you have a different bird's eye view of the process, you also can see how different people, what different people need to make a film happen and what are the ways that they stand in their own way, right? So some people the money thing is always so tricky. And a lot of directors will really kind of stress out about the money, which they should, right? And sometimes the stressing out about the money is a procrastination tool around not dealing with another big creative hurdle that feels too big, right? I'll know that the director is doing that and I'll be like, but we have this other, I need you to focus on this other important creative hurdle, right? Or there are some, there's some people who, I mean, I could give a litany of examples, so I won't, but what I'll say is I do think that everybody has the parts of the filmmaking process that are more challenging to them and that they feel like they can do everything else but this one thing. And you have to kind of figure out, for me, for example, as a director, because I produce, I procrastinate by producing. It's hard to produce for me because I know how to produce. Like I can, in documentary, in fiction, I don't produce fiction films. I have no interest in doing that. But for documentaries, because I've produced so many documentaries, when I can't figure something out creatively, or I don't know what I want a moment to be about, or I'm having a hard time getting an interview or something, I will immediately go to a producing element and try to solve that problem. That's not my job,
Yeah.
So I think every field, everybody has the things that they do like that. Yeah, I mean, I think film also, there's just the whole business part of film that filmmakers are more involved with than maybe other fields in a way. Like, you've got to play, quote, the game in some way, whether you want to or not, you have to. And you have to just make sure that you're still being creative and not just playing the game. And that's what I really constantly remind myself of. And that's why I keep my own projects, because so much of the film industry is, playing the game.
I love that. Angela, thank you so much for taking the time. And especially now when you're kind of in this very intriguing place with your current work. Thanks for everything. It really means a lot to me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. This is such a fun conversation.
You can find Angela Tucker at tuckergirl.com. That is TuckerGurl.com. Or on Instagram at tuckergirl, spelled the same way. And her newest film you can find at bellyofthebeastfilm.com. My name again is Dan Blank. You can find me at wegrowmedia.com or at Dan Blank on social media. Thank you so much for listening until the end.